Hi, I'm writer and editor Stephen Jones.
I'm novelist and critic Kim Newman.
And we're here to talk about Something in the Woodwork, which was originally broadcast on Night Gallery on January the 14th, 1973, and is based on a short story by an old friend of ours, Ron Chetwynd Hayes.
Yeah, which we are pretty sure that Rod Serling or somebody else found in the third Fontana book of horror stories edited by Christine Bernard, which was published in 1968 in Britain, but reissued in America by Berkeley, not as the Berkeley Book of Horror Stories, but still as the third Fontana Book of Horror Stories in 1971. Now, if you look at the contents list of that anthology, it includes Green Fingers by R.C. Cook and The Academy by David Eli, who had both been adapted as earlier Night Gallery episodes. So presumably they just knocked them off. It also included The Shuttered Room by Lovecraft and Derleth, but the movie rights to that had gone.
But it's interesting. I mean, I think we talked about this in one of the earlier commentaries we did, Kim, that it looks like a bunch of stories from the Fontana books and from the Pan books of horror. People obviously had them shipped over and went through them. But I think you touched upon the interesting thing that it's actually Rod Serling himself who adapted this story. And that didn't always happen. No. The actual story is called Housebound. They changed the title for this. And really, it was only Ron's second published story. Yeah. So you've got to say, you know, for a new writer to get your second published story turned into an American TV show, I know Ron always said he thought this is how it was going to happen. Yeah. And, you know, he's going to be rich for the rest of his life. And like Basil Copper, who we talked about on a previous set, it just never happened, unfortunately.
And Something in the Woodwork is a line from the story. So Serling has done that thing.
It's a better title than Housebound, I think. I mean, Housebound has that meaning. It's a clever meaning. And they'd already done an episode called House with Ghost, so they couldn't use that. But I think Something in the Woodwork is quite a nice version of it. My only concern is, having reread the story, you know, prior to us watching this episode, I don't think Rod Serling quite understood the story. And I mean, the one thing about Ron, as we've talked about before in other commentaries, is he was a very urbane writer. He liked to throw some humour in there. He wrote cosy horror more than anything, because it was very much a sort of 1960s, 70s.
But he
British
was also
horror.
Subtle and creepy.
Certainly in the early days when he was writing. Yeah. I think he was a lot cleverer writer in the first decade of his writing. And there were little twists and undercurrents.
Associate him with the rather more humorous stuff that he moved on to write.
In later days, yeah.
But actually, even his humor is kind of barbed in this particular story, which is actually, it's a study of a loveless suburban marriage. And it becomes, in Serling's version, the story of a horrible, horrible woman.
Yes, a completely neurotic woman.
And quite a lot of Serling's Twilight Zones fall into this category of, and one or two of his Night Galleries too, they present a character you're supposed to hate that something terrible happens to. And you have this parade of crass, obnoxious, usually middle-aged men, although sometimes horrible women as here. And they all feel a bit refugees from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Or indeed, some of the Rod Serling's live TV scripts from the 1950s have similar. They are character studies of awful people, of people you wouldn't want to be around for an hour and a half. So it's quite good that we're only here for 25 minutes with... I think Geraldine Page really attacks this role. Whoever gave her that outfit, it was exactly right.
But Geraldine Page played nothing but neurotic women on the screen. I mean, this is her third Night Gallery, so somebody obviously liked her a universal. Yeah.
I really love this little performance here of the guy who cannot wait to get out of the house.
And Paul Jenkins, his only Night Gallery episode.
We've only been here for 5 minutes and we agree with him.
It's like, I'll drink my coffee and go. No, she gives, I mean, really, you know, it's her show on this one. And it is interesting because in the original stories, you know, Kim, basically it's about a put-upon husband. And also a put-upon ghost, actually,
but,
as well.
Yeah, it's, well, the husband in the story is sort of smotheringly awful, but polite and quiet. It says that it's about a woman who doesn't realise how much she hates her husband.
That's right, and the husband doesn't realise she hates him at all.
Yeah.
And that dynamic goes through a lot of Ron Chetwynd Hayes' stories. He basically used that kind of dynamic between the husband and wife.
There's that terrific From Beyond the Grave story about the children, the wishes of little children, with Donald Pleasance and Angela Pleasance, Ian Bannon and Diana Dawes in
Well, they get to wish their parents away.
And that's the perfect Ron Chetwynd Hayes story. And also, I think it's the best single adaptation of his work
and
into another medium.
Because it's got that grey, miserable 1970s look to it. Whereas here, the whole story is transposed from English suburbia to, I guess, you know, Californian... I mean, smartest. I mean, Ron could never imagine a woman wearing a costume like that in one of his stories. They'd be wearing a very plain, simple, dowdy dress.
I remember in the short story that's adapted into the Ghoul episode of The Monster Club, there's a bit where a typical Ron Chetwynd Hayes protagonist is talking to this half-ghoul woman to try and convince her to help him escape. And says, well, we can go to normal places and you can shop at Marks and Spencer's and watch television.
Yeah.
And you realise that's Ron's idea.
I'm afraid that's exactly where that was the middle-class suburban atmosphere he came from. So I think when Serling got to adapt this for an American audience, ostensibly an American audience, I think he had to change the way
it
played.
The social milieu as well is very different. It is upscale Californian rich people. It's Leif Erikson with a much younger girlfriend and a great car. The house is, I mean, it is actually the house that's in most night galleries, isn't it?
It's just a redressed, gorgeous,
old, dark, creepy house, whereas in the story, it's a boring suburban house. There's even a thing in which I watched this again before I reread the story, and it just seems weird, the backstory, that there's been a shootout in the attic.
Well, actually, that is the one thing that jars, of course, because in England, you wouldn't... I think it's the Siege of Sydney Street. You don't have a lot of shootouts.
But in the story, it's suggested that the robber was killed by a sniper from across the street going through the attic window.
Yeah.
It's the bedroom.
Bedroom window.
It's the bedroom window in the story. So it's written to be credible. Here, you wonder, how the hell... Why did they have to have a shootout? He was stuck in an attic. There was nowhere else to go.
It is a bit of something that the plot turns upon, I'm afraid. But I would love to see Ron's original Housebound made like from somebody like Mark Gatiss or something.
Yes,
I think
that's
could
right.
turn it into a really interesting story.
It's what in Britain we now think of as an Inside Number 9 story.
Yes, very much
because Inside Number 9 is basically Night Gallery for Britain in the 2020s.
But I mean, they are sort of dowdy and grim and down at heel and downbeat. I remember, I think the first time I saw Geraldine Page was in Whatever Happened to Aunt Alice at the cinema.
Yes.
She basically cornered the market for a while. And The Beguiled, of course, she's in as well with Clint Eastwood. She knows what she's doing in these episodes.
Her in... You're a Big Boy Now. She's sort of not bad. And she did move into some quieter things. There's a little film called The Trip to Bountiful she made in the 80s, which is a very moving, underplayed middle-aged woman character story.
Which a lot of older actresses didn't they?
Yeah.
They moved into
Whereas
that kind of thing.
This is her in her full venomous mode.
This is her Baby Jane moment.
Yeah. I don't know if she ever played in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but if she did...
She would have commanded the stage, and you would have to be a good actor to stand up to her. But again, you know,
she was also married to Rip Torn, who would have been great as George if they'd done
that. Would have been a great double, wouldn't it? In Virginia Woolf. Wow,
I don't think they actually acted together very often, but they are straight. You can see why the marriage works, because they're about the same size of personality.
I'm wondering how it worked actually. Yeah. I suspect your conversation about what we're having for dinner kind of went crazy.
Yeah, well, Rip Torn famously bit off Norman Mailer's ear at one point during an artistic argument. So
But again, I thought a nice, crazy actor. Now, it's interesting you mentioned you called him Leif Erikson, because all my life I've called him Leif Erikson until he was introduced in these credits as Leif Erikson.
Yes, so I assume they got it right.
I presume. Yeah. There's Barbara Rhodes with him, who was a Universal contract player. And in fact, he's still around today. She's one of the few people from Night Gallery still alive. And her only other genre credit I remember her for knew was where Scream Blackula Scream.
Yeah.
In roughly the same time period. And she was a pretty good actress. I mean, she's wasted in this. She has this one little scene or whatever. Right. And you've also got to say, you know, Leif Erikson's doing pretty well for himself, as far as I'm concerned, in that scene.
Oh, she's in Conspiracy of Terror, which is one of those witchcraft TV movies about that.
Actually, quite a good TV movie, that, as well.
But mostly, again, her credits. Oh, and she's in a Kolchak, The Night Stalker. But, yeah, you usually found her on Mannix or Starsky and Hutch or Ironside or Harry O.
Both those things you mentioned are all Universal things. She was obviously under the contract, and they just bunged her in these. Now, the one thing I realised watching this, and of course we know Leif Erikson from being, you know, Big John Cannon in The High Chaparral, which he was, you know, he did 97 episodes between 1967 and 71. And although he was a film actor back in the 50s, he was known as a TV actor. But, of course, he actually got his start again with Universal back in the 1940s. He's in Night Monster with Bela Lugosi and Lionel Atwill in 1942. And I suddenly realised something when I was watching this episode, which had never occurred to me, I don't know what you think, Kim, is Night Gallery is basically the final hurrah of the Universal horror cycle going back to the 1930s, because it's the last time they got to use people like John Carradine and these actors. And you suddenly see how Universal back in the 30s, not the silent era, but the 30s and with Frankenstein and Dracula and the Mummy, this is the final time on TV
and I suppose
that horror was done with these kind of people.
And they did have a Frankenstein and a Dracula, mostly in comedy episodes. But I think, you're right. You could say
and it's
that
a transitionary series into the new horrors, the Sixth Senses and the Ghost Stories, where they're bringing up new directors like John Badham and Jean-Luc Schwartz.
And, of course,
said.
John Badham then goes on to a Dracula.
Yeah. You know, and that I find quite interesting. So in many ways, if you're a fan of Universal horror in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, then you're now seeing in the late 60s, early 70s, the final basic Universal horror. Because they once after this, they never really went back. I mean, Kolchak never worked. It was set in modern times. Here, they did different stories at different times.
You could see it as the final mutation of the Inner Sanctum franchise.
Radio as well, because a lot of these stories were done on radio, as well.
And the back and forth between radio horror and TV horror is still rather an unexplored area. I know that some of Chetwynd's stuff has been done on British radio.
World Service, the BBC,
That really terrific story set in a bomb shelter, which is a story that takes place entirely in the dark. I don't know if he wrote it as a radio script, but it is a perfect radio play.
And, of course, Vincent Price did one on his BBC series.
Yes, that's right,
as well.
The Price of Fear.
The Price of Fear.
Which was about... In fact, it was before this, wasn't it? It was 1971, the first season.
All around this period when horror was... The horror boom was on again here. Yeah. I mean, we're almost at the period where Stephen King's going to be coming up, James Herbert's going to be coming up.
I always think that there is a real end to the horror cycle comes at that moment where Milton Subotsky has the rights to a bunch of Ron Chetwynd Hayes stories and a bunch of Stephen King stories and makes the Chetwynd Hayes film. And it's like he had a choice between the Beatles and Acca Bilk, and he made It's Trad That.
But I think, Amicus like Hammer were very British in their outlook. And I think that's obviously what killed them at the end of the day. But I can understand how they did that
Although Milton was an American and he knew enough to buy Stephen King stories.
Oh, absolutely.
Which Michael Carreras didn't.
But then you look at a lot of those stories were done as Dino De Laurentiis movies later, with Milton got a producer credit for buying them and then selling them, and made probably a lot of money. But, I mean, you look at some of those stories that Dino did, Cat's Eye and those things, they're not very good films. They don't stand up very well. Whereas I would imagine if they'd been done, and they weren't out yet, we're still a couple of years away, but done in this half-hour format, they could have been quite good, actually.
Yeah, no, I think that, obviously, by the time the Tales from the Dark Side and Monsters came along and were buying not just Stephen King, but other...
Yeah.
80s horror authors.
Contemporary new writers.
I mean, with the best will in the world, Tales from the Dark Side isn't as good as this.
Oh,
they
no,
don't have the
monies. Either,
they
no.
don't have the studio resources to
they're
do
not slick.
This creepy
they're not
stuff.
Slick. And they don't have the actors by then either. I mean, I know they've got some really good actors in that, in both Tales from the Dark Side and Monsters. And they do use a lot of old actors.
But they don't have... I mean, this is a really weird, eerie image. It is a lot like that terrible Star Trek episode with
exactly
Frank Gorshin.
That's exactly what I thought.
The half
of
black, half white.
And this is weird because it's not in the story. It's obviously it's a director's decision to do that. And the director was Edward M. Abrams, who really has no other real...
It was one of his first jobs as well.
This is his only Night Gallery directed, or he did edit the Night Gallery pilot for Steven Spielberg. And this is quite leisurely in that respect, but it's not a particularly well-directed one. I wouldn't. This is one of those sort of journeyman director episodes.
Yeah, except this weird thing is really interesting, isn't it? I mean, he uses mirrors and reflections rather than more obvious trickery. I've not seen a ghost who looks like this before.
No, or again,
and there may be a reason for that.
But I think that was the other thing with the story. The fact that he was killed in the bedroom allowed you to have him in mirrors and wardrobe.
Yeah,
the attic. Whereas here, the attic's a bit, he's just sort of appearing behind a pillar there.
There's also something like creepy sexy about the fantasy guy being in the bedroom rather than...
He's really intruding on the marriage,
and
isn't
as
he?
I say, Geraldine Page had appeared in a film called Toys in the Attic.
Toys in the Attic.
Which very much says what the premise of this show is, isn't it? Here, the ghost epitomises her craziness rather than her desire.
And I wondered, and as this was moving on, whether that's where we were going to go with this, whether basically it's all in her head and she is as crazy as she seems. I think the end of the episode actually gives a lie to that.
Yeah, Serling never went with that as an out. For somebody who started out as a mainstream writer, he wholeheartedly embraced the supernatural without embarrassment, whereas quite often, as it were, higher-toned writers who want to do ghost stories say, oh, it's probably all in her mind. Yeah,
but I think this is one of those where it would have worked quite well for it all being in her mind, because she is set up as such a crazy person from the get-go.
Yeah. Oh, and just a word for how good Erickson is playing off...
Excellent.
It must have been a nightmare to... Yeah, because you look at the script and he's got all the dud lines or the flat lines. All he has to do is be stiff and reasonable and an idiot,
What's nice about he's very sympathetic in this. He's trying to help her. I do find it weird that his character's name is Charlie Wheatland, which is the name of the ghost.
That's right.
In Ron Chetwynd Hayes' story.
Yeah.
So I don't know what was going on there. I mean, the ghost in this is called Jamie Dillman, and is played by a guy called John McMurtry.
Who I admit I have never heard
of. No, he's only Night Gallery, small number of credits, and then seems to have disappeared in the mid-1980s. But, I mean, for some reason, I don't understand why Serling would give the husband the name of the ghost, unless, I know, he's being post-ironic or something. Leif Erikson, I think, it can actually stand his own in this. It's again, an interesting role for him, because, as I say, he's mostly known as a cowboy at this point in television. And he's a big, he's physically a big actor.
And it's what I think of as a Ralph Bellamy part.
It is very much a Ralph. Yeah. And they could have got Ralph Bellamy at this point, of course. He was around still.
He's slightly less humorous than Ralph Bellamy, which was because you have a sense that this is a man whose patience wore thin 15 years earlier. Who probably put up with her longer than anybody else would have done.
And he's still going around at her beck and call.
That's right. When she calls,
he picks up the phone. Yeah. He's there.
And she turns on a dime from "Here's your birthday cake. Let's get back together." To "Your scum."
Yeah,
you know.
The mood swings are crazy in this, and he obviously still has something for her, and he's still willing to go out there and check her out and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So. A truly sympathetic character, nicely played. But I think he was a great actor anyway. I think he was a very interesting actor. Even back in Night Monster in 1942, he actually gives quite an interesting performance. And when you're sharing the screen with Lugosi and Atwell, you've got to stand out a bit.
Yeah, we've seen that circular attic window quite a lot. In,
well, it's like it's Universal backlot. All these houses were standing there, and they were all available for filming. It's, you know, it's the street that Marcus Welby had his office on. It's the street the Munsters had their building on.
Is that, in fact, the house that's in the Mummy movies? And yeah, you, it, it's got a very distinctive set of columns on the veranda. But because it has a sort of slightly tropical look as well, but it's also all this decor, isn't it? I suppose it, it's characterising the woman by the clutter,
bric-a-brac. Yeah.
Although, yeah, Serling would do more of that in the Twilight Zones. You'd have much more stress on why somebody was awful. Here, there's no reason for the wife to be just a terrible person.
I think she is.
Yeah. Whereas the short story, it's more about the wife realizing how terrible her life is.
Yeah, I mean, she's a victim.
Rather than that she's an awful person.
Yeah.
And in fact, even the husband, who is a terrible person in the story, doesn't realize how awful he is.
Is he just dull?
Yes.
He's just dull and controlling.
Yeah.
Do you know who's up there?
Some kind of...
And we're coming to the... what was then a twist ending, which is now the ending of pretty much every horror movie or episode. I think Dan Curtis staged this ending 4 or 5 times. It's in Burnt Offerings and Night of Dark Shadows. It's almost like every horror film of the 1970s ended with somebody being possessed and lurching evilly to the camera.
I think so. But I think also when I was watching these episodes in season 3, you get the sense that actually Dan Curtis watched this whole season and learned a lot from all the episodes.
Yeah, I think probably the last minute possession, is it? The Haunted Palace is the first time we get that as a punchline for a horror.
It could well be. Yeah, 1964.
But then it became, and it got,
especially in the early 70s,
it got to the point
Cry
where
the Banshee does it with Vincent Price.
Yeah,
there's all that stuff going on.
A trilogy of terror ends like that. It's like it's almost the conventional finish of 1970s horror.
But I think what's clever about Ron Checkwind Hayes' story is there is still a twist in that ending, which you don't see normally in horror stories, where basically the ghost doesn't want to be freed. I mean, the whole point of the story is the ghost wants to stay in the woodwork.
And actually, I think it's the best line in the story, and Serling recognises it because he puts it in here, isn't it? I was happy in the woods.
Yeah,
it was peaceful
and wanted to just stay there. And it's her who's conjured him up out of the house for her own reasons and for her own beliefs. And I think that's very interesting. I mean, Ron did write a story called The Sad Ghost, which does cover the same kind of area. But it was again a recurring theme in his stories that, you know, sometimes it was the monsters who were the victims and the humans who were the bad guys.
A word of credit for Bill Jobe, who was the costumes guy on this, also on Kolchak the Night Stalker and Kojak.
And I suspect we use some of these on Kolchak.
I don't know. Did he just, you know, go to a local store and pick out the clothes that a middle-aged funky woman would wear? Deliberately pick something so hideous that it characterises her? Because, frankly, you can see clothes this bad, you know, on actors and actresses in any 1970s TV
and jewelry
programming
as well. These huge
the way
jewelry.
That she clashes with everything else in the episode suggests that she has been costumed with some thought to character.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, the fact that the house is so mundane looking and yet she just blows everything out.
She spends all her time drinking these cocktails as well.
Which might be one of the problems, actually.
Yeah.
But it is a neat little ending, because even in the story, when, you know, she thinks she's gotten rid of him, and then she hears the creak of the floorboards and then the sound of steps coming down the flight of stairs. And obviously, we as the audience are meant to think he survived somehow.
Yeah.
And this is like, you know, this takes it to another level, which I think is quite interesting for early 1970s TV. And we don't have that weird makeup, you know, with grey under the eyes or anything. You know, it's
there's a touch of it, but
no, there's a touch of basically what he's doing is he's walking as if he's not used to wearing a body, which I think is quite clever. Actually, it's a subtle touch.
And yeah, it gives you the horror actually purely in the acting rather than the boogada boogada stuff.
There's no actual, you know. He's not carrying a knife or an axe or anything like that. It's all done in the performance, and suddenly she realises what's going on, and she's released this spirit from the woodwork. It's actually a nice little ending on this. Not one of my favourite episodes, I got to say, in season three, but it's solid, and I think that's what you often say about Night Galleries. They're solid. So there we are. So another episode. I thought. Pretty good, as far as I was concerned.
That's right. Kim, happy with it.
Based on a published story, and I think that's always that elevates these episodes a little bit.
Yeah, there's a little more content than some of the stuff that is just thrown together to fill the schedule.
And we'll be back in a while with our third and final commentary on this set, and again, based on a published story.